I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I met one artist there that sort of, I just knew instantly if I would start a gallery of my own, this would be someone I would approach. And so I did.
Oh, wow.
While she was still a student. Yeah. And that was Eloise Hosser, who's based in London.
Dagens gjest driver galleriet Sixes and Sevens I Bjørvika, og det ble startet I 2012. Gjesten vår I dag heter Esperanza Rosales. Hun amerikansk fra New York og utdannet kunstner.
Det hun, men Esperanza fant ut at hun passet bedre et annet sted I kunstverdikjeden, og har siden vært både kurator og kunstskribent, og hun også har jobbet for det amerikanske rockebandet The Strokes I New York. Og Esperanza kommer også fra New York.
Og nå sitter vi her I studio og skal snakke med henne her på Smestad. Hun skjønner litt norsk, men vi skal ta episoden på engelsk, så derfor vi kommer til å hoppe over til det.
Det, og så vi jo da veldig begjæret, fordi Esperanza og galleriet har en nyhet, og den skal hun faktisk slippe her I podcasten.
Ja, så det skal vi komme mer inn på. A warm welcome to you, Esperanza.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Very good to have you here. So you just opened a new exhibition with Tobias Kaspar, who's from Switzerland. How has the opening weekend been?
Oh, it's been wonderful. We had lots of visitors this weekend. We had the good weather on our side as well, which was great. And so, yeah, it's going well. It's a strong start.
So what kind of works are you showing?
We're actually showing a great deal of works on paper. Mm-hmm. It's part of a project. It's actually a restaging of an exhibition that we did or tried to have in 2020. This was difficult, of course. We couldn't have the public in the space. And so together with the artist, who had been to Oslo since then as part of an exhibition that traveled to the Astrup Fearnley, we decided to restage the show since no one got to see. Yeah.
So did you actually put the exhibition together in 2020?
We did. It was just a couple of months, or actually it was the first month that we got access to the new space, so our new unit in Bjørvika. And at the time, we were not allowed to let the public in due to COVID regulations, so that was a bit of a pity. And it's a pity also because it was a great project that took a look at pop culture and celebrity life. It was a sort of remaking of the entire last issue of Interview magazine. That was a magazine started by Andy Warhol in 1969. And the last issue that came out in 2019 before the COVID outbreak, the artist drew all the pages of in ink. So beautiful ink drawings. And we showed 52 of them. I and my colleague, we were the only ones that got to see. So the tragedy of that is that people could see through the glass, but you know,
it's not the same.
No, it's not the same in delicate ink works. They can look like Xerox copies when you're at a great distance. Yeah. So that was a shame. But so we've got, we did a sort of light edit of the body of work, and we introduced several new pieces to the configuration. And several nice things came out of that project, even though nobody saw it physically.
I mean, you have around, like, what, 20 artists or something
yes.
in your gallery?
Yeah.
And most of them are international artists. So how come?
Yeah, so we represent about 18 artists at the moment. And quite a great deal of them are internationally based. And international in terms of nationality, though as the years go on, we're starting to represent more and more Norwegian artists. And so I think we're almost, soon we'll be at half.
Okay.
Yeah, probably take another year or so. You know, coming from abroad, my network was international already. I had a connection to the Norwegian art scene, but I also wanted to take a little time to get to know the practices here. And so that was a sort of, you know, development over several years. And in some cases, it took almost, you know, 7 or 8 years before I invited an artist I'd been watching into the program. So I try to make
quite a lot of time.
Yeah, it is. It can be. It's I try to make careful choices about the program, and of course, representation involves quite a lot. It's a big commitment, so it's something, you know, to be carefully decided.
Yeah, sure.
But why don't you tell us a little bit about the artists, well, some of them, that you have in the gallery?
Sure. Well, I mean, gosh, we have it's a wide range. I think one of the things that makes our gallery quite different is that we tend to work with artists who are working with a range of mediums. So with few exceptions, most of our artists are not working in a medium-specific way. So we have a couple of artists that are making, you know, they're painters, but most of them, I would say 8 or 9 out of 10, are really working with different mediums. And, you know, the work varies project to project based on the conceptual underpinnings of the work. So they will choose the medium that's appropriate to whatever idea they have. I can tell you a little bit about someone like Eliza Douglas, who's new to the program. We did an exhibition with her last year, and the show sold out before we opened. It was incredible. So she's an artist who's American, but currently based in Berlin. And she's basically making paintings which are looking at a wide range of graphic t-shirts. So she's basically remaking them in a very realistic style, but so that they are a bit torqued. So they look as though someone has like worn them and taken them off. And that creates a really interesting sort of abstraction of the image, which then says a lot about, you know, culture and the relationship between commodification and painting. So it's a really interesting practice. The pieces look great and they circulate well. So they've been represented in museum shows. We were actually contacted by the Museum of Contemporary Art in Rome after we did that exhibition, and they wanted to restage the entire thing, which, you know, delighted me, which was a great idea. Yeah. In the end, the artist wanted to make new work for that occasion. But one thing that was really special about that exhibition is even though they were paintings, she took it one step further by adding backdrops. So she wanted to make it look as though she wanted to create a sort of surreal experience for the viewer. So rather than just looking at paintings on a white wall, she wanted to actually make it seem as though you were standing in the Whitney Museum of American Art. And that was a very interesting challenge, which we managed to get around by creating vinyl backdrops floor to ceiling. So every single wall of our gallery was covered with a backdrop that looked like it looked like you were looking out on the Hudson River in some of them, which was very interesting because of our, you know, proximity to the fjord.
Yeah, sure.
And every wall had a slightly different perspective than it did in the, you know, in the photograph. So it was sort of it created a very jarring and surreal experience that was really memorable for a lot of people. And so that's, you know, a little bit what I mean about the fact that the artists are thinking also conceptually alongside these more popular or easily accessible practices or mediums, rather.
So where do you find your artists? Do you like have like certain criteria or something when you pick them?
It's a great question. Actually, you know, it is a little bit of an organic process. So we get approached by a lot of artists, and of course we meet a lot throughout time.
And international as well, or in Norwegian?
Definitely international. Yeah. People are writing. I would say once a week we get at least several inquiries, which is always interesting to sort of take a look at.
But is that mostly fresh, new artists, or can it be more established ones?
It's a full range. Okay. No, it's not normally more established ones. Usually people who don't have representation. Yeah. Mm. Though sometimes people do have representation and their representatives reach out to us.
Okay.
So that's normally not the direction we go in. So we started the gallery with a sort of core group of artists that I kind of knew through my time living in Europe. And there were particular schools that we were looking at. So, for example, the Städelschule in Frankfurt, it has a really interesting program and a lot of artists who go on to be represented by galleries tend to go through that school. Several Norwegian artists as well have done that. And because of my previous work, I was working for a German art dealer who was, he had a gallery in Brussels. You know, he was a graduate of that school and was working with artists from there. And so it was sort of part of the, I guess you could say the lexicon of work that I was looking at. And I used to go to the open days. So when they had, you know, artists presenting their work. And I met one artist there that sort of, I just knew instantly if I would start a gallery of my own, this would be someone I would approach. And so I did.
Oh, wow.
While she was still a student. Yeah. And that was Eloise Hauser, who's based in London. And it was a very organic process from there. So, you know, one artist either introduces you to another or you meet someone. I met another one of our artists standing on a balcony after an opening. and it tends to be, of course, when you're putting together a program, you look at the things that you yourself are interested in. And that's a way that I think a lot of galleries start. So, you know, some sort of an introduction between the artist and the gallerist that sparks something. Mm. And then, of course, you know, being very convinced about the practice. So feeling as though, you know, when I met that young artist in Frankfurt and she was studying, I think she was in her third year of a BA, a bachelor's degree, she told me straight out in a very confident way, I'd missed her work. So, you know, it was the end of the day and I hadn't made it to her particular, you know, where she was showing her work for the open day. And she said to me, you know, that's such a pity because I'm a really good artist. And I thought, she said that. Yeah. And, you know, I've heard that before in many different ways. You know, artists who are either extremely confident or in some cases maybe overly confident mm-hmm. and a little pushy. And this was not that. This sort of somehow felt, I could see that she truly believed that and she was confident and strong about saying it. And I thought, oh my gosh, she's probably right. So I actually got back on a plane a few months later. I told her I'm gonna come and see your work. And I did. And sure enough, she was completely right. It was refreshing, unique. It really stood out, you know, and apart from what, you know, some of her peers were working on. So yeah, it can be in all different ways.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how did like a New York girl end up running a hat gallery in Oslo?
Great question. Well, I never thought it would go this way. I'll say that. I mean, you know, my background in a nutshell is I studied as an artist in New York and transitioned from that into working in the music industry and learned, I think, a lot about artist management there. So when I sort of re-entered my practice, you know, after that, I guess I reached a point where I was thinking that I felt like a better ambassador for other people's work than my own. And I started writing as a critic. I also worked in a couple of galleries.
And in New York or?
No, this was in Brussels, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I was based in Brussels for a couple of years.
So you had already moved to Europe then?
Yeah, I moved to Europe to study in the Netherlands.
Yeah. Okay.
Did a master's there and then moved on to Brussels, which was not so far away. And that was an exciting time. It was an exciting time. And there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of really interesting artists that were based there and producing interesting things. And it was a kind of unique situation. And I started to visit Oslo around that time. So that was in 2008, 2009.
Okay. Any particular reason you went to Oslo? Or?
Well, you know, I traveled there to attend, or here now, to attend a conference that was at OCA. It was on art writing, so very linked to what I was doing, you know, back in Brussels. And on that visit, I had a friend who was a Swedish artist. He'd done a lot of exhibitions in Oslo before, and I said, I'm going there and I don't know anyone. Who should I meet? And he put this list together for me. And on that visit, I met so many incredible people.
Great friend.
Great friend, very well connected and very open about sharing contacts. And, you know, it was just an incredible trip. It was 3 days in town. And I left, you know, really having built a network here. I also had a couple of friends who were Norwegian artists who were living in Berlin at the time. So I felt like quite a lot of roads were leading to Oslo. Based on that trip, I met, you know, two incredible artists who were about to open their own artist-run space. And, you know, artist-run spaces, they're not really a thing in New York the way that they are here.
Okay, what's the difference?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the commercial art scene is so developed in New York. and real estate, access to spaces. Mm-hmm. It's all a kind of different thing there, you know, less in reach. And I think here, the commercial scene is a little bit, you know, it's sort of still in formation in relation to something like New York or London. And so there's a lot of artists who decide to make the kinds of spaces that they feel need to exist. And that creates something really interesting. So I was quite taken by that. And I started getting, you know, invited back to Oslo to do certain things, curate a show. I think I was an external examiner at the Art Academy at some point.
You must have made quite an impression then on the three-day trip.
Oh, it was, yes, it was an unforgettable time here. And I felt, you know, coming from New York and having lived in London and Brussels and other places, I felt like it was completely unique. It was really different in a very nice way. So it's sort of, and I still feel that way, you know, 11 or 12 years later, I still feel like, wow, it's I don't really tire of it.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I mean, you have a lot of international artists, and you also go to fairs and whatever with your art. But your customers, are they primarily international or Norwegian? Or?
Well, interestingly, the first, you know, definitely the first half of the gallery's life, or maybe the first 7 years, 7 or 8 years, it was largely an international clientele. So we did a lot of art fairs before the pandemic, sometimes up to 6 a year.
That's a lot.
It yeah. was quite a lot for a gallery our size, and but it was essential. Like, it was essential on two levels, both to be, you know, for our artists to be represented in that sphere, but then also because really we were selling to, I'd say, you know, 9 out of 10 of our clients were abroad. And then COVID happened and we moved into this new location in Bjørvika, which has shifted a lot for us. So
okay.
I think it's a combination of me spending more time here, you know, and really kind of having, you know, boots on the ground. I used to travel every second week to another place. And, you know, with our artists being abroad and, you know, our clients being abroad, I just needed to be on the go. And so I think that was one very positive shift, is me being forced to spend more time here. And then also, certain things, certain programmatic decisions. And then, of course, the new space, which, you know, I guess there was a shift around the time of COVID, because prior to that, I used to think, well, if people are truly interested in art, they'll know we exist. Or, you know, if people want to find us, they'll find us. And with COVID, you know, the sort of need to communicate became so much stronger. You know, it's sort of like suddenly we really had to think about how we communicated what we do, and to just, you know, simple things like telling the public we're open or not open led to, oh, maybe we should also tell people we are moving to a new space. Or
because you used to have your gallery next to Blomqvist.
Quite near Blomqvist, same
yeah.
street.
Same street, yeah.
Same street, a little bit closer yeah. to the water. And they were great neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah. and we were there for 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And previous to that, you were in Grønland somewhere, weren't you?
Exactly. So yeah. the gallery started in Grønland. Mm. We were, the space was literally underground. So quite an edgy, unforgettable space for people who remember it. And we were there for only a year, you know,
okay.
Or just a little bit over
quite
a year.
Quite an impression then, because a yeah. lot of people are telling me out.
Exactly.
The Salas Gallery in Grønland, yeah.
Yes, no, it was yeah. a wonderful time. Maybe it was closer to 2 years,
no,
but
then
yeah. we moved sort of briefly to Gamle Byen.
Yeah.
That was interesting. We were there for a little bit less time. Yeah, not the best conditions with the space, though a very interesting part of town. And then we made the move to Tordenskjoldsgata.
Mm. Yeah. So you moved around a lot.
We have. This is our fourth space.
Yeah.
We have a longer lease there, so it's exciting to know that we've been part of the start of the area. So we signed a contract on the unit while this area was still being developed, and, you know, the unit wasn't built. When I saw it, it was just, you know, a pile
construction
of mud.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a construction site. Yeah, so... Yeah.
But is it a goal to keep moving it around, or do you are you comfortable in Bjørvika? Or
we're very happy there.
Okay,
yeah. For the time being, it's working really well, and again, I think it's created sort of some accessibility. I loved when we were on Tordenskjoldsgata, and when we were there, I thought nothing could be better. This is great. But, you know, they had stopped traffic in the area. Yeah. And slowly I realized it wasn't really a part of town people wanted to be in, even though it's beautiful down there.
Yeah. It's very quiet.
It's very quiet.
It's become very quiet.
Yeah. Exactly. Lots of government workers who go home at 3. And, and I found that people weren't really just dropping by. So that's a bit different now. You know, we're in an area where I feel as though the residents take an interest in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And that feels really nice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, yeah.
And I also feel that Oslobukta, as it's also called, is a place where people go just to walk around and see what's happening.
Yeah,
either it's to eat or to do some shopping or to just see the new buildings and explore.
And that's probably the mix that makes people want to go there.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's a combination of so many things, like really interesting architecture that somehow, you know, got it right in terms of the area spatially feeling very open and welcoming. Yeah. And so great, you know, attention to detail and surfaces and material. And then just, you know, really interesting tenants. So there are a lot of artisanal businesses in the area, smaller sort of, you know, designers, lots of clothing designers and things like this, great places to eat. And then tenants who really care what's taking place in the area. So the feedback has been largely positive.
That's good.
Yeah.
But what is the new project that you were going to tell us about? Oh, we are so excited.
So it is exciting. I have to say, very exciting for us. So we are putting together an exhibition of original works by Edvard Munch.
Wow.
And it has been a long time since a gallery has approached doing that. It's truly exciting for us. So of course, I can't say everything about the project at this moment.
But maybe you can tell us a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. How does it work? How do you start a project like that?
Well, I can say that we're showing works that are being loaned from private collections.
Okay.
Some of the pieces will be available to be acquired, not everything. And of course, a lot of research goes into something like this. So we've been working on it for quite a long time now. And
what does quite a long time mean? Is that years or?
In some cases, quite a long time can mean up to 2 years.
Yeah.
but we have been working on it, you know, intensively for a great length of time. Also to think about how to approach it in terms of thematics. And of course, lots of works by Munch are in museum holdings around the world, or with, you know, international private collections. And we are very excited to have, you know, been able to create and have access to the works that we do.
So what kind of works are we talking about?
They're going to be graphic works. And for the rest, I can't say confirmed yet. I mean, if things go according to plan, there will be an original painting. We're very excited about that. And of course, it's a tremendous responsibility to care for such, you know, an important piece of art history. So I can say that we have access to more than just a single painting that is available.
For sale or for just to show?
We do, you know, because of being a gallery, we get approached quite often by collectors interested in reselling work or, you know, things that have been in families for many generations at times. And so we do have access to more than just what is going to be exhibited. And that's also exciting because I think by doing the show, we also send a signal to people to let them know that we're here and we are also, you know,
selling on commission.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think
But is that also a new thing for you, or have you been selling on commission before?
You know, I think most galleries, a lot of galleries are actually, they have to do this. It's sort of a part of things. I mean, it's helpful from an economic standpoint. I mean, being able to sell works on the secondary market or, this is something that really allows you to finance projects by younger, maybe more unestablished artists. Or, for example, you know, maybe you do a show with a more established artist that is more experimental. If it's not the kind of thing that's easy to place in a collection, Then the secondary market sort of helps a little bit, you know, behind the scenes mostly, which is why it's nice to be able to externalize a project where we can actually bring that more to light. Because, of course, we do function as advisors for certain collectors. You know, someone who starts buying at the gallery after a period of time might say they want to shape a collection. And that's really exciting when we're given a little bit of, when someone is actually using us and our...
As an advisor.
Yeah. So this is a natural extension of that. Yeah. But we haven't done anything, you know, of this value before, you know, in terms of our public program. So that's why it's, you know, also incredibly exciting for us. I mean, and I should say the most exciting thing is that it's Munk, of course.
Yeah.
But the prices, and we have to talk a little bit about prices too. So what's the price range approximately of the artists you have in your gallery?
That's a good question. So, I mean, we, as recently as a year ago, we had works, you know, original works by artists as inexpensively as 9,000 kroner. And that's probably the lowest that I can think of anything in our inventory.
And what kind of piece was that? Do you remember that?
Actually, it was a paperwork by Martin Sather, who's a wonderful Norwegian artist who joined the program last year. And his work is really interesting because he's working with elements from Norwegian design history. And one particular body of work, this series sort of takes a look at paper napkins. You know, there are some people who have these napkin collections going back as far as maybe the 1950s.
I did that when I was little.
Oh, did you?
I did as well.
Oh. I've got to let Martin know.
I don't even know why I started it. No. But I did. I used to like collect every time I found some sort of unique.
That's so lovely.
That's fun.
It is really fun.
How about you, Esperanza? Yeah.
You know, I definitely appreciate a good print. I see one. Absolutely.
Maybe not a New York thing, collecting of napkins.
But certainly, it's a project that's really interesting because he's making collages from these napkins and fusing them with handmade paper so that they become an actual object. Mm. And these, it's very unique work.
Nice.
Yeah, I've not seen anything like this before. And so he's also looking at other things like, you know, materials that are... maybe fetishized in a moment and then forgotten. They become sort of, you know, like stria tapet. He's working with that as well.
I heard that was hot again.
Yeah, perhaps.
Oh, really?
Perhaps.
Okay.
I haven't heard that so much yet, but but maybe, yeah, it could be making a comeback. Very interesting artist. And some of those napkin works, you know, the smallest were only 9,000.
Nice. And the most expensive.
And the most expensive. Oh, good question. So primary market works by an artist we represent, most expensive right now has been around 450,000 kroner. And that was for a 5 meter long painting. Jørn Hanke Øgstad.
Oh, yeah.
So it's still, you know, I would say for a painting that is like 2.10 meters high, 5 meters long, less than $500,000 is a pretty good price.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah.
Especially by an artist who, you know, there's been a lot written about.
Absolutely.
She's in a museum show right now and acquired by several museums as well.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well. I just interviewed Callum Innes, I think I told you about that. Yeah. And he said to me that Norwegian art is quite cheap.
Mm.
What do you think about that? Do you share his opinion? Or?
Well, certainly in relation to the international market, this is true. And it's not to say that everything is always priced correctly, because I see a lot of younger artists who are sometimes pricing their work quite high in relation to where they are professionally, you know, in their career. But definitely, I mean, when you think about the fact that you can at auction buy artists, you know, paintings by artists that are in the National Museum collection, and they're still reasonable, you know, quite affordable. I would say yes, it's not quite the same, the international. And I think, you know, this is true of the other Scandinavian countries as well. You know, the prices are a little bit...
So if you take, for example, Jorunn Hanke's mm-hmm. art to an art fair in London,
yeah,
I mean, would you ask for the same price there as in Oslo?
Yeah, we do. And that's
because... And you run your prices in which currency?
So when you buy from the gallery, we're pricing in kroner.
In kroner, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, if we do a fair, let's say in London or New York, we will always create an equivalent price.
Yeah.
For the local buyer. Yeah. So we work with several artists that are based in the US. So for example, you know, someone like Eliza Douglas, now her prices are
very high in Norway.
Yeah. Yeah. So well, they're, you know, tied to the dollar. Yeah. Mm. And but no, I think it's really important. I mean, we definitely try to price our artists to the international market.
Okay.
But always with the awareness that if an artist is young and emerging, it's far more important to get the work out there, you know, that interesting, responsible buyers start to acquire the work. Because, you know, there's no point for it to sit in a storage if it's overpriced, right? It's, you're not going to sell it, because collectors know. They, you know, it's... So we're trying to do everything always in a very careful, responsible way, but more to the international market. And that might... make some things seem too high, but I don't think so, because we're also not, you know, raising prices unless there's a really legitimate reason, like a museum show or the substantial one or a catalog. Like there have to be artists that work with us have to take certain steps before you will see that price increase.
Some criteria.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
So who's a typical buyer of sixes and sevens?
A typical buyer. Oh, they're all different, aren't they? But of course, several of our clients work in finance.
Okay.
One of our clients is a filmmaker. You know, in terms of profession, it's a full range of things, really.
I think Constanze Tenvik, because we did a podcast in her apartment, and told me that, she had bought some art from you too.
She did, actually, and that was wonderful. I mean, it's always
Kulisek,
really...
Kulisek, I think.
What's that?
She
bought Rob Kulisek, exactly. Yeah. And, I mean, for us, it's always a good sign. Of course, we're really happy. I mean, don't get me wrong, when collectors visit the gallery, but I think a really encouraging thing that happens is when artists mm-hmm. that are good, like Constanze, take an interest in what we're doing. Because I think if you only have, you know, other professionals coming by, and by that I mean critic, curator, collector, but you don't have the interest from the artistic community, then it might be a sign that you're doing something wrong. So for me, if I see, you know, students from the Art Academy, artists from town, artists from abroad coming, and we do get that as well, it's a good sign.
Do you give them a better price?
That's a great question. You know, artists, they tend to trade their work between each other as well sometimes. Yeah. So, you know, good on Constanze for coming to the gallery to do it. You know, we don't want to create barriers. So if people do come to us and they have, like, you know, we always try to make it possible for the work to be accessed. So payment plans are happy to work with that. Mm. We try to do what we can. Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, it is.
So who are you having the gallery for? Is it mainly for the artists, or is it for the clients, or for yourself?
What a great question. My instinctually, I almost said, yeah, sure, for me.
Yeah, with people you like. And
yeah, well, yeah. It definitely fulfills a certain interest that I have. Mm-hmm. And I think my job is to convey, you know, to share that and hopefully make people feel through my enthusiasm for the work an interest. And so definitely for the artists, because, you know, as their representatives, you know, we're in charge of doing quite a lot. But, you know, our aim is to make something that we get excited about as a gallery more widely known. So, you know, the point is that it leads to more exhibition opportunities for the artists, that more people become aware of the work. So I feel like we're just a constant spokesperson for something we care deeply about and that we believe in and that we also think is, you know, a place where people should shift their focus and attention. But it definitely feels great. You know, there are moments where there are lots of things we do that are unrelated to the actual work, of course, you know, the logistics, the administration. But those moments where you realize a new project with an artist, it can be incredible, you know, where you finish installing something that didn't exist a year before, 6 months before. And then those moments where the artist asks you what you think, you know, you arrive at some decision together.
Do you like questions like that? Or yeah. Are they difficult? Or how honest are you?
Oh, no, it's really wonderful. It's a balance, of course. Yep. Some artists are interested in your feedback and some are less. So after time, you get to know who's like open to feedback and how to deliver it, and who might just need encouragement to figure it out on their own. But of course, I'm always happy to talk about the work and the projects, and this is an incredibly exciting part of things.
Yeah. Do you collect yourself too? Or?
I do, actually. I do.
And tell us about it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I guess the first things, my collection sort of started because artists were giving me things. And I didn't think about it so much in the moment. I was just like, oh, that's nice. And one thing sort of led to the other. And then I guess, you know, I bought a few things here and there by artists I was really like interested in. Smaller pieces, editions sometimes, but, you know, really cool things. And then I guess when my son was born, for his first birthday, we bought a work together. We went to see a student show, actually. And I was like, well, maybe a good birthday present is a work of art.
Oh, very good idea.
I thought it was great. Yeah.
That's great. Never heard about that. One-year-old.
Yeah. And then it was such an incredible experience. So, you know, we were looking at the show together as
what
family.
Did you buy?
I guess I can say we bought a piece by Anna Sophia Mathiasen. And she was a graduating student at the moment. And her presentation at Kunstnet & Sus was really good. And I would have bought, I mean, I think she showed 4 or 5, you know, wall-mounted works. I would have bought them all. But we picked one, and it was great. And, you know, we saw the show as a family. It felt wonderful. And all I could think about was sort of what, you know, story the work and then this having acquired it together would tell later on, you know, so in 20 years. Yeah. And so I thought, well, that was fun. So the next year we decided to do it again, but since he was turning 2, I was like, okay, well then we'll buy works by 2 different artists.
Oh, nice.
And it kind of just went from there.
So how long ago was that?
He's 3 now.
Okay.
And did you buy 3 works?
Yeah,
it's being very expensive.
Yeah, no, it is. It's true. But you know, I mean, I think
that's fantastic. But
it's a perfect excuse to buy art.
Yeah,
then.
It's a great.
But is it his art or your art?
No, it's definitely. Yeah. I am. So I've got a collection of my own. Yeah. But I am also building a collection for him.
Yeah.
And it contains more than just because you know I think the thing about collecting is it's a little bit addictive, when you start, it's sort of, you start to just like want to do it all the time. And so Tobias, who we're showing right now, a few years ago, actually during COVID, he had a project and it was called Rented Life. And it was super interesting. He decided to make these lots like in an auction and different projects. And so he would put a price on it and collectors could buy in order to finance a certain aspect of his life, whether it was taxis or champagne or rent. And it was a beautiful project. And so I looked through the lots. He sent it to me, of course, and was like, distribute it on, please. And of course, I thought, well, what an amazing thing to have access to. So I flipped to the lot that was champagne. I can't remember the lot number now. And it was 12 paintings that were made to color match different kinds of champagne.
Nice.
And I thought, oh, this is nice. And it was a, you know, a fairly reasonable price. And I thought, 12 paintings, I'll buy it. And so I did, which I'm sure he appreciated a lot. And then I suddenly got a request a few months later that a museum in Geneva was going to do a solo exhibition with him. And they wanted to borrow back the entire project, Rented Life.
Wow.
And so just a few months after making that decision, a piece from my collection was requested for loan by a museum and fully insured, you know, transported away. And you know, is in the catalog now. And it's just, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Great experience. So it's a wonderful thing. And of course, you know, someone like Martin Sather, that's an artist. He's one of the few artists I actually collected before inviting into the program. And my interest in the work is in terms of acquiring it is no less now than it was then. I think it's a good sign of things. You know?
So how many pieces of art do you have? If you have 12 from Tobias,
I guess it's less than 100. I should really do a proper, I should know this perhaps. Yeah.
Plus your son's six works.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just growing and growing. Yeah. But
you buy, if you buy art from one of the artists in your gallery, I mean, how do you like... what kind of guidelines do you have for like who should be able to buy it, yourself or the client? Sorry.
Well, it's a great question. Yeah. And I can definitely say that there are certain things I haven't bought and I've regretted it later on. So I can think about in particular one, a piece by Jochen Schmidt that I still think about to this day in the show was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I should have bought it. And of course, it's more than tripled in price. It went to a great collection though. So I try to prioritize, you know, the best placement of the work. I would say within my collection is not a terrible place to be. But of course, a collection with more visibility, you know, perhaps if it's an institution or it's going to have a public, you know, public facing view, you know.
Might let someone else get ahead of you.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think the connoisseur in me, I know for sure when I see a good work.
Yeah.
And you just... you know, part of the job is editing. So, you know, you edit what you put out there. You always try to prioritize the best pieces, mm-hmm. you know, to be seen by the public. So that part of the brain doesn't ever switch off. And so when you, you know, unpack a crate or you're looking at a PDF of a selection of works by the artist, as a gallerist, you know, instinctually, like what is, what's the museum piece of the bunch? And if there is one. And so, yeah, that's... absolutely. And I've done it before. I've blocked sales before for pieces that I thought I need to have. Of course. But that's why, you know, collectors need to be quick.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, we could sit here and talk for hours, but we have to be able to invite you back and have something more to talk about.
Maybe we can step by the gallery one
day. That would be fun. Oh, yeah.
Episode there.
Do
that would be nice.
On site. Absolutely. That would be great. Yeah.
So shall we have a last questions and maybe about the name of the gallery, Margrethe? What do you think?
Yeah, I have no idea what's the stories behind the name. So
it's Roman numbers and a lot of people are like, how do you pronounce it?
Yes, it is very mysterious. Yeah. So I don't, you know, there were a few things I was thinking about when I came up with the name. And one of them was about this sort of like neutrality. And I thought, you know, galleries very often should be neutral, like not too strong in their branding or their design and things like that. And so I was thinking about neutrality and Roman numbers, but also this expression sixes and sevens, which, you know, came out of, I guess, 17th century dice throwing games, they say, etymologists think. And, It has to do with risk. So it was an expression. It's an expression in British English that is used disparagingly if someone makes a choice that other people view as like reckless or ill thought. That person is at their sixes and sevens. They're not thinking clearly.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, because, you know, six was the highest you could roll on the die and seven is the impossible. So I loved that idea of the impossible and like that risk, the turn.
So the risk
of
buying the art from sixes and sevens?
Well, no. That was not the kind of risk, but of course, you know, there's a risk, but there's risk inherent, of course, in good art, absolutely, all the time. And artists, just by being artists, are taking a risk. So for sure, it's a part of things. And I also thought about this turning of the die and how with a good program, you should never be able to predict what's coming next. If you're like, oh, another painting show or, another, you know, it's about creating something that feels like it's always growing and changing, moving forward, developing through the artist practices, but also how you select what you're presenting when. And so I wanted the program to never feel stale or stiff. And I thought, so like this turning of the die that, you know, so each subsequent show would be and feel different.
I really like that.
Great.
I'm so glad we asked.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all the questions.
So great to have you here today, Esperanza.
It was a big pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to see you. And I will have to come back to your gallery for the next time.
You're very welcome anytime.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Om det noe annet dere ønsker at vi skal ta opp, dere som hører på, så det bare å sende oss en e-post på kunstpraten@kapital.no.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Kunstpraten en podcast fra Finansavisen. Programleder Margrethe Hegnar og Kari Nestås. Produsent Lars Brenden Skram. Og ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegnar.